History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We aim to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained. So often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. At the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. this past Friday, May 8th, a handful of World War II veterans were on hand to mark the 81st anniversary of VE Day, when Germany's unconditional surrender in the European theater brought cause for celebration throughout the globe. A year ago on VE Day, I had the privilege of facilitating a program with World War II vets in Clovis, California. Both of the veterans who spoke that day just a year ago are no longer with us, and I delivered a eulogy at the graveside service for one of them this past week in Reedley, California. We're going to dedicate today's program to Vern Schmidt, who was as full of life, energy, and future plans as ever, right on up to his final breath at age 100. Every vet we've met over the last 21 years of this endeavor has left a powerful impression, but I have to admit, there's never been a veteran other than my own grandfather that I spent more time with or felt more of a kinship with than Vern. We first met back in 2005, not long after he had been in Washington, D.C. for the dedication of the World War II Memorial. The first person he introduced me to was a man named Bruno, who had been in the Hitler Youth, captured by Vern's division, and felt those American soldiers had saved his life. Vern was a collector of friends around the globe, connecting more genuinely and memorably than perhaps anybody I've ever known. The book about his life is called A Hero and Advocate for All Others, and there couldn't be a better caption for his life. We're going to start today with some thoughts he shared way back in 2009 on Hometown Heroes, taking us back to the teenage farm boy who ended up in Europe with the 90th Infantry Division.
2 weeks from the day I boarded the Queen Mary in New York, I was on the front lines fighting two enemies. One was the Germans, the other was the weather. So it all happened it was in a hurry.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that, both the Germans and the weather. And your friendship with one of the Germans that technically you guys were fighting over there that has survived all these decades and been revived, in fact. But before you left for Europe, you had a girlfriend here in the Valley that you were pretty fond of.
Yes, we'd been going together for a little over a year, and we talked about marriage, and yet we were just both 18 years of age, and we just made a decision that we would wait. So the night before I left home here in Reedley, I gave her an engagement ring, and I says, when I get back, we'll tie the knot. And at that time, really not knowing what that entailed, but you know,
didn't know if you would ever see her again.
That's true. You didn't know that, but you know, that billboard used to say, Uncle Sam is called and I must go.
Well, and we'll leave the listeners hanging for a little bit to get the other end of that story with Donna, your sweetheart, back in 1944. And only about a month from the day that you proposed to her, gave her that ring and said, here's the ring, but I'm going overseas. About a month later, there you are on the Siegfried Line.
Exactly. I gave her the ring on January the 8th, and on February the 8th, I was in a pillbox in Hapscheid, Germany, ready to go.
Ready to go, indeed. Did you really feel ready to go? Were you a little nervous? I mean,
well, I had read that many of the divisions that formed up after they got into England, especially, did additional training. But and I kind of expected that probably would happen. But when I got to Scotland, we traveled by train around to Southampton, England. Got on an American ship. Went across to the bombed-out harbor there at Le Havre, and rappelled over the side of this American ship into those Higgins boats that carry about 50 guys, mm-hmm. And we just rammed up on the beach there at Le Havre, and From there, we've boarded the old famous 40 and 8 boxcars. Cold as old Billy get out, and snow coming through the cracks in the of this old rickety 40 and 8, and we rode for 3 days.
And it doesn't snow much in Reedley, does it?
No, we can see it in the mountains, but that was about it.
You weren't quite ready for that. And for those who don't know, and regular listeners to this program, I've heard an entire show about 40 and 8 boxcars, and the one that's in Fresno, preserved outside American Legion Post 509. But that's called 40 and 8 because it could fit 40 men or 8 horses. They used them in World War I, transported troops all over the place. Not exactly a Pullman. Didn't quite have those accommodations for you.
Didn't see any windows in it, but it had cracks for the snow to get through. And a little bucket in the corner for you-know-what. That's about it.
Now, at this time, you're still just a young kid, a teenager. Are you feeling a sense of adventure about all of this? Or are you starting to get a little anxious and thinking, this could be it for me. I might not live to see 20 years old.
Well, you know, you're young, so every day was an adventure, so to speak, but there was a lot of unknowns. I had never been out of the state of California until I got in the service. So, you know, we were, I guess you'd say, we were considered sheltered. So, it might have been an adventure, but it was so cold you didn't have a chance to enjoy the adventure. And I became ill on that 40 and 8 and had, you know, you had to chill because it was so cold. So it was totally different from what it was right here in California at the time. This was Hitler's West Wall called the Siegfried Line, mm-hmm. which was 400 miles of pillboxes and tank obstructions and objects to slow down our forces.
A whole lot of concrete.
A lot of concrete. And they're still standing over there.
And you actually occupied that pillbox to watch out for German forces?
Well, we was taken into the pillbox mainly for a cover over our head for the night, because the following morning at 6 o'clock, the sergeant I reported to said, we'd just make yourself comfortable here in this pillbox, because 6 o'clock in the morning, we all jump off. And I wasn't sure what he meant by that, but in the morning at 6 o'clock, I certainly found out. We jumped off and began taking one pillbox at a time until we had literally accomplished our mission, which was to take hold and secure each pillbox, make sure they were free of Germans, and make it secure for us to keep moving eastward.
Did you meet with any resistance?
We have sporadic resistance. This was now only a couple of weeks following the climax and the catastrophic efforts or events that happened at the Battle of the Bulge. So the Germans had tenacity, but I actually feel that many of them felt for them the war was lost. But because of the fanaticism in their Nazi regime, those men were told they had to fight to the finish. And we found that out from that area clear into the closing weeks in Czechoslovakia. So there was that determination to hold off, because Hitler said there's a secret weapon coming.
Thankfully, the United States was able to use its secret weapons eventually, and Hitler did not.
That's right. The night times were the roughest. We never knew where we were going to stay, because you had accomplished a mission that was programmed for you, and hopefully you could accomplish that mission on a day-to-day basis. But the Germans knew exactly where we were, because they had been there just hours before or maybe a day before. So they had us pretty well zeroed in, both by machine gun fire and at times sniper fire and mortars and also artillery. But it was scary. The nights were the most scary, because you didn't know really where you were. Many times we didn't even have a shelter to get into. I've slept under bushes, and I've slept in makeshift foxholes, and I've slept in German-made foxholes, and woke up in the morning to find a dead German in the hole. I wondered why he never spoke or never said a thing all night, but in the morning, it turned out to be a dead German. So for a kid 19 years old, it was tough. you yearn for your friends at home and my wife to be and my parents, being a replacement, you never really got to know the people because you just lined up in. Three of us joined that very same night. In 10 days, I was the only one alive out of those three. Mm-hmm. And I really only got to know one of those really well because we had trained together at Camp Roberts. So those were tough days for a kid to walk away and leave your buddy laying there just almost cut to shreds with our German artillery. They had a gun called the 88, and we became very conscious that of the accuracy. We said, if they saw you, they could put it in your back pocket, and I believe that. It was an accurate, straight trajectory, and it exploded before you heard the muzzle blast mm-hmm. from the gun itself. And it was a wicked piece that they had, and scary. It was scary, especially at night when you didn't know where you were. And a couple of times, or one time to be exact, Axis Sally got on the loudspeaker at night, and we began to snow, and I was just under a bush with my raincoat, and she began talking to us and telling us how nice it would be to have a nice warm bed and a nice hot meal, and that we were surrounded by Germans, soldiers, and all we needed to do was surrender, and everything would be just like a brand new life with us. We'd be nice and warm. We'd have a hot meal, which is those two things we never really saw hardly at all until the war was over.
On a certain level, that's pretty tempting, isn't it?
It's tempting, but I think we were trained that there would be a propaganda machine trying to wean us away or mm-hmm. sympathize or get our attention. But by morning, we had not surrendered. We were covered with snow, but another day in the battle in the woods. We had started into the city, which was the city of Mainz on the Rhine and Main River, in a city of about, at that time, of not quite a half a million. But we entered the city through an apple orchard and then into the chicken coops, and the chicken coops into the first houses. And we had taken fire from the SS there for probably an hour or so, and we were laying in a prone position in this apple orchard, and finally our artillery began to zero in on the Germans ahead of us, and then their artillery began to zero in behind us, so we were caught right in the middle, and so the only thing we had to do was get up and go. So our sergeant gave us a marching order to everybody at the marching order, which you just take your M1 at hip level and march and fire as you move along, which is pretty devastating when a whole group of guys get up and do that. And then my BAR man and I, we ran to the first house to secure it to see if there was any Germans in there. And there was nobody on the ground floor, so we went up the second floor. As if some of you have been to Europe, you know their houses are very, very close to one another. As we came up on the second story and into a room and looked out, not more than 25 feet away was another house with the window just like ours, and there stood two big Germans with their helmets and everything. And I thought, oh, man, these guys have seen us. And they ducked, and I turned to my BAR man, a big, tall Yugoslavian guy by the name of Mike, and I said, Mike, I said, those guys are going to come down and go into the cellar and come up and get us. And he edged himself over to the window, and I was right behind him, BAR, out of the window, and sure enough, out came these two guys, and they were kind of trying to get into our basement. I don't say this in boasting or trying to say we were macho, but he leaned that BAR out the window and did what we were trained to do, and that was you either kill or you be killed. And he fired off a part of a clip, and he looked back at me with a big grin. And he said, Smitty, they ain't coming up. Again, I feel my life was spared. But that went on, you know, and going into the building, I either a sniper or some small arms fire got me just as I was going into the building, hit my boot, and I felt my foot just lift up automatically, and fortunately all it did was graze the heel of my boot. Another inch or another 2 inches, and I might have had a hole through my ankle. But again, I firmly believe the good Lord is watching over, because too many things happen to me over there that don't just happen and aren't just luck. I just have to thank the good Lord that I knew him as my personal Savior, and I believed in whatever happened, he was in control.
You know, you talked earlier about a month before you ended up on the Siegfried Line, you had proposed to your girlfriend Donna back in Reedley. And throughout the war, you two wrote letters to each other. You've saved all those letters?
We've saved, I never knew this till I got home, that she had every letter I had. I just put them in a box once in a while and sent them home, because, you know, we didn't throw anything away in those days. And the ones I wrote to her, of course, she saved. And so we had a whole big box of letters. And every now and then, we open them up and share them together. We talk about different holidays and Easter and birthdays and Valentine's Day, the things we wrote in that time. Even during combat, you look back, and it's the things that held us together. Mail was such an important thing. And sometimes it took so long to get one that some days I would get 5, 6, and 7 letters at a time from her. And I'd rather read her letters than eat. But it was so comforting to know somebody at home saying, "I love you. I can hardly wait till you get back home." And those were reassuring words, because 7,000 miles away, you once in a while you got a little depressed.
Understandably so. Do you remember the moment that you saw her again when you got home from the war and this really was happening? You got to see your sweetheart again and you could go get married?
Right out in front of the Greyhound bus depot in Sacramento, California. I had got separated at Camp Beale and took a bus into a Greyhound bus into town, and I had written about the time I would be discharged and so forth, and my folks had brought Donna up with her and my sister, and my brother who had been liberated had now been living in Sacramento, so I had a rip-roaring family welcome when I got off that bus. And to see, I think I ran to Donna first, because we had been separated over 19 months, and I tell you, she looked good, and she still does.
Vern and Donna enjoyed more than 68 years of marriage, and not long after her passing, a chance, or was it, meeting at People's Church in Fresno, where Vern's celebration of life is going to take place May 29th, led to a second marriage with one of Donna's best friends, Vi, who became just as wonderful a life partner for Vern for 9 years before her passing. Now Vern Schmidt, too, has left us at the age of 100, and we will continue to celebrate his legacy as Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode in tribute of Vern Schmidt, an incredible ambassador for veterans everywhere whose joy, enthusiasm, and incredible ability to connect with anybody, anytime, and anywhere endeared him to dignitaries and strangers alike around the globe. I had the privilege of making many appearances over the years with Vern, facilitating the recounting of his World War II experiences at schools, at service clubs, church groups, and more. And no matter the audience, standing ovations tended to follow him around because his heart for God and for others always came shining through. The most recent chapter of his adventure came with the publishing of a book about his life, A Hero and Advocate for All Others, which Vern requested all the proceeds from go towards Central Valley Honor Flight so more veterans could visit their memorials in Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, I have to say, I guess I'm humbled and surprised and happy that that book has seemed like the book has caught on pretty well. The sales have gone well, and the three people involved whose names are on the front of the book all come from the same area in North Carolina. And each one had a part of putting the book together. Got a call to go down and meet a gentleman who, a Jewish fellow who runs a Jewish organization down there in Arizona. And he said, Vern, we're going to interview you from the standpoint of being an American GI in Europe. We're also going to have several from the Holocaust, several survivors, Jewish people who survived the Holocaust. They're going to give their story. And then I want you to give yours of what you saw and how you reacted on from this occasion down at the Flossenbürg concentration camp. And one of the authors heard about it, and she went down there to listen. We really didn't know who she really was. I just knew she was a friend that had a family that served with me during World War II. So she sat and gathered information. Laura was a little bit different. She's an unusual lady and also came to Fresno to see me. She said, did you ever write something down? You got a book? I said, no, I have a little story I wrote for my kids, my three children. Can I see it? And I said, yeah. So I said, I'd like to take this with me and read it over. She never said anything about a book coming out. So when the book was published, I get one of the first copies of her book. I didn't even know there was a book coming, but she shared it with me, and I was, how do you react when somebody writes your story? You know, Laura has been special. Her family's been special. Her husband been special to us. They've been in our home here in Fresno, and I'm glad you asked her to share with you.
Laura Bailey, the lead author, talked about the book on a previous episode of Hometown Heroes. Vern was planning to join her in North Carolina for a special book signing this June. And as he would have wanted, that event will go on. It'll be at the Greensboro History Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina on Thursday, June 4th at 6 p.m. I have a link to it for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Another of the many friends Vern Schmidt made around the globe is the granddaughter of one of World War II's most famous generals, who this past year showed up at Vern's home with some unique dog tags in a commemorative box.
Well, being Helen is the granddaughter of General Patton, she had these specially made, like the official dog tag that we wear during World War II. You can see the notch. Do you know what that notch was for?
For your tooth, right?
It was if you were dead, they took one of your dog tags and opened your mouth and placed that over one of the teeth. And so she had one made, or two of them made. One is General Patton's official dog tag remarks and so forth on it. And the other one is his lovely bride. When the war was over officially in the first week of May of 1945, General Eisenhower released him to go home to California and bring his wife back with him to be with him while he's serving over there. Because he had plans, Eisenhower had plans to form the Third Army, which was going to be one of the official units to serve in the time over there. And so anyway, that's General Patton's wife, and they assigned some numbers and stuff to her. Those are real people.
So General Patton's granddaughter, Helen, came right here to where we're sitting now, to your home in Fresno. Did you give her one of your books? Did you sign a book for the granddaughter of your commanding general?
She has a book.
I bet when you met General Patton, you didn't think you'd be signing a book for his granddaughter someday.
Well, I did meet General Patton over in Europe. In fact, he came down to the 90th Division to visit our general, and we heard he was in town, and I was kind of fortunate. I was a Jeep driver for the company captain, and I had some free time, and I heard about, they said General Patton's going to be here and meet the general on such and such a day. Well, I planted that in the back of my head, and on that such and such a day, I drove right down to 90 Division headquarters where I knew our general would come out of the door. And he came out of the door, and General Patton followed him, and they walked right by my Jeep where I was standing. Now, I met General Patton. Now, he didn't meet me. He might have seen me standing there and wondered who this truck driver is standing out here. He should be busy. But anyway, I did meet him right there, and to me it was a thrill, you know, because I did a stupid thing when the war ended. I was over there in Germany and so forth. I was down in the area in southern Germany where, when General Patton was in his personal armored car and was struck by another truck, and he was killed in that accident. His staff car had a metal screen between the front seat and the back seat, so he could be pretty secure sitting back there in the seat. Well, when this truck hit him, it threw him up against this metal screen, and a portion of it took just sliced right through his forehead, and he was dead, you know? And one of the units that I served with, the commanding officer, a full colonel, he and General Patton had gone through West Point together and received their commission in World War I. So that unit was asked by General Patton's wife and others, "You're in charge of General Patton's funeral." And that was the unit I was serving with. One day a guy came, I was in the office working there, and he came down and he said, "Schmidt, I noticed you're 6 foot something." I said, "Yeah." He said, "We need some pallbearers for General Patton's funeral." And he says, "We're doing it on a voluntary basis." He said, "You're one of those that we chose to do it if you wish." Well, we were about 150, 200 miles away from where he was going to be buried up in Luxembourg at the Luxembourg American Cemetery. And I had been there. And this was in the dead of winter, January. And I said, "Okay, how do we get from here to where the funeral is going to be, where he's going to be buried?" And he said, "Well, you guys were riding in the back of a 6x6 truck." I said, "Is this voluntary, or am I supposed to be there?" "Oh, no," he said, "Vern, we're just coming down and picking guys that are 6 foot tall or bigger to be pallbearers," because Patton was a tall man. And I said, "Well, if that's how we're going, count me out." You know, talk about a fool, that was me. I turned down an offer to be one of the pallbearers at General Patton's gravesite. When I met Helen, I said, "Helen, you'll never believe what I did to your grandfather." I said, "I turned down being a pallbearer." She said, "Vern, I probably would have done the same thing knowing how cold it was and how you had to get there. Forget about it." I said, "I can't forget about it." I said, "I've been back to his grave at least 3 times. And the first time I went back to his grave, I got on my hands and knees, put my hand on his cross, and I said, 'General, please forgive me for what I did to you. You were honoring me. Your people were honoring me to be a pallbearer.' And I said it was too cold." She said, "Vern, don't worry about it." I might have done the same thing. But I didn't. Both my big toes were already turning color, and if they'd gone to black, they'd have had to cut both of them off. But I tried to protect myself, and they slowly went back to halfway normal. And today they're still cold. One day you can just feel one of them's cold, the other toes are warm. But anyway, that's my story of General Patton. I think if we would have had more General Pattons over there, the war would have ended sooner. He took some awful stories about him when he supposedly slapped a couple of guys. You know, who knows what story? Only he was there, and only he talked to those kids. And yet the story comes out in all kinds of magazines and you know, the stories we heard over the radio and whatever about him slapping these two kids. You know, maybe he put some sense in their head by slapping them. Anyway, he took a real beating on that alone. But I have sat under one of his speeches. I tell you, thrill your heart to hear him talk and honoring the troops. It's an honor for me, he said, to be in charge of these troops. And like I say, he was a real guy. He knew what he was doing. That's my story about my friend General Patton, that I had to go to his granddaughter and ask for forgiveness.
And you've got a lot of stories, and a lot of them are in this book, and we can't tell them all, but I'd love to for our listeners to hear a few of them. I've lost count of how many times I've talked to you about some of the things you did in World War II, but a lot of the ones that move me the most come back to your family and the place where you grew up in Reedley, California. You had to do some pretty tough jobs out there in Reedley. Did you really plow a field with a horse-drawn plow? Did you really do that?
Yes, I did. My dad was a foreman on a ranch that had three ranches. And before tractors came out, hey, we had a horse in the corral back there, and that was his job to get hooked up to a plow. And when I was working with my father during the summer or during the week, well, I'd work on Saturdays for my father as he was a foreman on these three ranches. So we had to do, if you had a vineyard, you did an annual job called a French plow. It was a special single blade plow made to go right next to the vineyard, to the vine itself, and get in the dirt and throw dirt away, and then fresh dirt put back where you remove this. And one day I was asked to go get the horse, and I got behind the plow and I plowed with this horse. So now that makes me a real old guy, I guess.
And we've talked before about your family. Your brother, your older brother, Glenn, would end up as a prisoner of war, have a long military career, not just in the Army, but the Air Force as well. But it's probably been a while since I've asked you about December 7th, 1941. You have a clear memory of how you got that news that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
This was a Sunday, and we'd been in church. Ironically, in this church, there was three of us teenagers named Vernon. So we kind of stuck together, and we decided after church we would go downtown and find one of the food restaurants and have a little food. So we're walking down the street from the church. It was probably about a half a mile from the church, going into Main Street in Reedley. And there was a restaurant there. In fact, part of my family helped build that restaurant. But anyway, we walked and got right up by it, and the doors were open, and the radio was blaring, and we couldn't figure out what this was, so we stopped there and listened. This was December 7th. They were reporting about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. Now, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, but we knew it was a long ways away. But we listened, and the guy was, you know, it was a reporter giving the blow-by-blow description of the Japanese bombing at Pearl Harbor. I think we almost instantly had a hatred for them. And yet in school, I had many Japanese friends. Reedley had a whole bunch of them living. They were all farmers, all workers, and their parents were dynamite for them to study and become something. They became personal friends. And then came this war, and they gathered them all up. He came to the Fresno Fairgrounds and then also north of town here and stuffed them full of them, Japanese families, ready to haul them away. We didn't know where or what or was any. Anyway, I recall a special train came into Reedley, backed up in there and on the Santa Fe tracks, and they loaded up the Japanese. Years later, our class of 43, we start holding reunions, and we had a bunch of people show up for our reunions. One of the guys said we were making arrangements to have the meeting and so forth and form a class reunion. And one of the guys said, you know what we ought to do at this reunion? We ought to call all the Japanese people that we can think of that were in our class of 43, invite them down there to be our guests. And to help them out, we're going to go down to Reedy High School office and have them make a diploma for each one of these people. We got together, had our original meeting there, and they gave me a diploma and said, that fellow right over there, when we'll call his name off, you go over there and you present him with his diploma. I went over there and I got so teary-eyed I couldn't hardly talk, presenting him with a diploma. And he saw it all wrapped, wound up with a ribbon around it, and big tears come down his cheeks. I mean, it was a crying session down there for a while, passing out diplomas way back when, and from 1943 to these guys. I'll never forget that. And I've run onto them since, and we've talked about it. The 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was in Europe, had a lot of really Japanese people in it, and they had a big meeting here in Fresno, and I went and joined them and met some of these guys. Here comes those guys that we cried together when they got diplomas. But, you know, they were people just like us, you know, just like us. So I think our people who knew the real story did the right thing and respected them and became friends and whatever. So those are real World War II stories.
Vern Schmidt's World War II story is one that's been heard in so many places around the world and has inspired many more through that book, A Hero and an Advocate for All Others. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear a few more of those stories as we remember a man whose light shines just as brightly even after his passing. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to honor the legacy of Vern Schmidt, who was still looking forward, with quite a few engagements on his calendar when he took his final breath at age 100. One of those was his monthly meeting of the American Ex-Prisoners of War chapter, which he led for a quarter century in honor of his older brother Glenn, who had been a prisoner of war in Germany during World War II. Vern and Glenn were two of the men prayed for around the clock throughout the war at their church, Full Gospel Tabernacle in Reedley, California. I've seen the altar of that church at the Reedley Museum, and it's got a list of 52 names hanging from it. And there's a story behind those names that every time I hear you tell this story, I get goosebumps. And now I love watching how a crowd reacts when you tell that story. So I can't see all our radio listeners, but I can let you tell that story. What's the story of those 52 names?
Well, in this church, when a person got his draft report and went off to war, they took had a plaque right by the pulpit there in the church, and they put his name there, U.S. Navy, another one, U.S. Army, Marines, whatever. And they put a name up there for everyone out of the church or a friend of people from the church. And that's where they got those multiple names. And someone in that church, including my mom and dad, someone in that church, 24/7, was on their knees mentioning our name in prayer. God protect that guy. Watch over him. May it be possible for him to come home unscathed. And, you know, two people in my wedding, my brother and a close friend, both were severely wounded. My brother was taken captive, became a prisoner of war, and his wounds, both in his facial area and in his back, never even got an aspirin. Never got an aspirin from the Germans. You know, that almost makes you anger inside, you know. Why didn't they help these guys? When he was finally liberated, after 3 months in Bad Orb concentration camp, because he was never had been treated physically from his wounds, they flew him home and flew him to Southern California to a recuperation facility. Mm-hmm. He got his first medication 3 months after he was wounded in California at a rehab medical station. So, you know, he paid a price. And the other fellow who was in my wedding, he also was severely wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. Came home, survived, got married, all that good stuff, and real friends. But that church, they were determined that those guys went off to war to serve us and protect us. The least we can do is get on our knees and call them out by name and say, "Dear Lord, watch over Vern, watch over Glenn, watch over Paul, watch over George over there." And like I say, every single one came home. You know, that's a real testimony, you know. And I've shared that many times because I felt people should know. Some of them called him, "Boy, guy, you were sure lucky." You know, in fact, a guy in my book said, "Boy, Vern, you were a lucky guy." My reaction in there was kind of, I don't know, I just said luck was never one of my favorites. But I said the good Lord brought me armaments. I met a Jewish fellow over there who they forced into a factory to make armaments to destroy American people. We had some Jewish work in our kitchen after the war was over to let our own people sit and eat without having to work. And we had these Jewish people from a camp come down and work with us in his kitchen. One of them I kind of befriended a little bit, and he came to me one day and asked, he said, "Schmidt, did you see or feel or experience any German artillery shells that didn't explode?" And I said, "Funny you should ask. We were in the woods, and the Germans were just on the other side of the hill, and they knew where we were. And they began dropping in special shells that would burst and make contact with whatever was nearby." And I said, I ran and fell into a small hole that the Germans had built. And I laid in there, and a shell landed less than 10 feet from me. Big artillery shell, about 24 inches long, about 6 or 8 inches in diameter. Landed in there, and I heard the explosion. Then when it hit with a big whoop, it just threw dirt all over me, but it never exploded. But telling this story to this Jewish guy, a great big grin came over his face. He said, maybe I saved your life, Vern. But somebody did. If on the firing device of one of these projectiles, if they leave a little tiny spring out or a little tiny screw in the firing device, it wouldn't fire. And this fellow was working on a line where those things went by, and when it came to his point to put the screw and the spring in, he just took it and put it under his tongue, and it went on by, and the next person just did some of the other assembly. So it was never known who actually did it. He said, had they caught us, we'd have been shot on the spot. But he said, until we left that place in the evening to go back to our habitation, we'd spit the spring or the screw out on the ground out there. Otherwise, it was under our tongue all day long. But he said, you were our friends. We had to do something to save you. And it just tickled him pink that I had been one of his guys. He said, maybe I'm the guy that did it, Vern. So, but those, again, how often would you meet a guy like that?
Well, and I've never met anyone who's met more amazing people all over the world than you have. You're a magnet for it. You and I have talked many times about the Flossenbürg concentration camp, and you just told that story about one of the Jewish prisoners who you met during that experience. There's another thing that you were involved in that I think people find fascinating. And they, in fact, they made a whole movie about it called The Monuments Men, where there were these treasures from occupied Europe that the Nazis had stored in salt mines. And you actually saw that firsthand.
And there again, I can't explain it, but we were in the town where salt mines were underground, and we threw a restriction on civilians being out after, I think it was 6 o'clock in the evening. This was April of 1945. When our men stopped these women, they said, hey, you got to be in a house. You're not supposed to be out after 6 o'clock. And the lady says, see her over there? She's pregnant. She's about to deliver a baby. We came out here to help her and take her over to a lady that's going to help her deliver her baby. Said, well, you better get over there quick. And the lady said, by the way, do you see that tower right there? Do you know what that is? No. Says you need to go over there. If you get in that tower and go down, you'll go down 500 feet and you'll find something there that we don't know what it is. something. We see trucks come here daily and unload in a cart, and they go down in a big elevator, huge elevator. I've rode in it myself. And we go down 500 feet where during the early 1900s, they had removed salt out of there. I forget the word. Anyway, they took the salt chunks and made salt for all of Europe, and they were called the salt mines. Our people didn't know one thing about that. But our division was chosen to go down that shaft, and they could not believe what they were seeing down there. It was wall-to-wall boxes, pictures, all kinds of stuff that Hitler had and his people had confiscated from, you name every country over there in Europe, there was something in the bottom of that where the salt had been. Our guys went down there, and they came back up, and they called General Patton, General Eisenhower, and several other generals. Says, you guys got to go down and see what's down there that belongs to people all over Europe. They could not believe it was Rembrandt paintings and all kinds of famous people who had made stuff, and it was in there that Hitler had confiscated. There was American money, German money, French money, Polish money. There was gold bullions, like a 12 by 12 by 12, solid gold that represented thousands of dollars. Today it'd be millions of dollars. And it was all stacked right there. So that's why our guys called General Patton, felt he should go down there and see it himself. And General Patton said, okay, we're going to get American trucks over here and load all of that stuff and take it to the city of Frankfurt. There's a huge building there that we have been in, and we can store it in there and sort it out slowly and give it back to who it belonged to. Now, this is General Patton talking. He says, this belongs to people. This is stolen property. It belongs to people. Ironically, they were able to disperse of almost everything down there, with the exception of, I think there was $300,000 or $400,000 that they couldn't recognize. And they turned around and gave it to the Jewish people to help their people who were incarcerated. So the money, whatever, somebody was blessed by a pregnant woman, I guess you'd have to say, because our guy stopped her. Today, if you go there, there's a Jeep down there with the lights on, 90th Infantry Division. Down there, and it's just, I've been there twice, taking my different family members down there. Unbelievable what you could see down there. There's a huge, huge auditorium. There's a stage built in there. There's lights, air conditioning, everything. And they charge people up on ground level to go down for a concert or something. So that's a money-making organization, belonged to the Germans. My first time there, they wouldn't let us go down unless we had authority or guards or something. And a lady went down with us. We rode down in American trucks, went down the elevator, then got into trucks and went around and come over there. And she helped tell us what it was all about. And it was her family that began to make a money-making organization that held concerts down there and charged people. And when I came the second time and went down, she said, hey, you're American. You've been here before. She recognized me. You know, like I say, you can run, but you can't hide. But we enjoyed that. It's, you know, they came with almost a convoy of American vehicles and took that stuff down to, and they even had armed airplanes up on top to follow this convoy down, because, I mean, today it would be billions of dollars. And they were all going in trucks with American drivers down there to Frankfurt to put it in this big storage building. You know, I looked back and I said, you know, we weren't all bad. I said, we did some good things. And that was one of them. And here I was, a part of the unit that was actually made it all happen. Now, I was a PFC. I was a guard. I was not chosen to be part of those people that did this, because my unit was commanded to go on up ahead and liberate another town up there. In fact, we got involved in liberating the concentration camp Buchenwald. There's credit made to our unit for helping liberate the Buchenwald concentration camp. So maybe we were chosen to do more dangerous work. One was saving money, and the other one was spending money, but firing at the Germans. Anyway, I've met people over there, the German people over there, who remember us back in 1945. You know, small world.
Yeah, 100 years old, and you were a 19-year-old kid then, and I've known you for more than 20 of those years, and you have just as much energy and enthusiasm today as you did back then. So some people may hear you and they say, well, what is this guy's secret? What is it that motivates you or inspires you or keeps you going?
Well, you know, we were a part of history making in World War II. And people should know the suffering, should know the joy, should know the perils, should know the bad and the good of what we did. In fact, the story in World War II, Battle of the Bulge, I spent 1 week the last week of the Battle of Bulge with that unit, and then we moved into Germany and kept moving till we wound up in Czechoslovakia and won the war. But, you know, I'm so grateful that I came home. My brother came home. My brother has since passed away. In fact, my whole family, I'm the only one left other than my children and some of his children. And so, you know, I'm grateful for being able to share some of that. Otherwise, they would never be told. You know, I think our news media was probably told what they could say and what they couldn't say. And we saw stuff that they probably didn't want us to share with the rest. So, but, you know, I was involved, and I'm just grateful that I'm alive and well and able to share my story, which I feel I'm not bragging, I'm just reporting of what we went through over there. My two big toes are still colored and cold. That's a long time. That's 80 years ago. But it's still with me today. You know, I'm just grateful for... This is a wonderful country to be in. And we're in a wonderful town that recognizes a lot of this. Wow. What a blessing.
Wow. What a blessing. A quote from Vern Schmidt that for anyone who had the privilege of knowing him is the perfect way to capture who he was and the impact he had. Wow, what a blessing. If you're one of our many listeners in Vern's home area in Central California, his celebration of life will be Friday, May 29th at 11 a.m. at People's Church in Fresno. Wherever you're tuning in today, thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you of a message that Vern Schmidt spent so much of his life declaring and also living in a way that added power to the words, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.